The Urbanist is brought to you in association with the Department of Culture and Tourism, Abu Dhabi. Saadiyat Cultural District, Abu Dhabi, is a beacon of hope and inspiration. A catalyst to spark growth and collaboration with museums and experiences, where art and science and nature and technology coexist.
The belief of Abu Dhabi that culture is the backbone of our society.
Stay tuned for a special episode of the show, in which you can hear His Excellency Mohammed Khalifa Al Mubarak explain exactly why and how Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi is the perfect place to collaborate, create and innovate. Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi, proud partner of The Urbanist on Monocle Radio.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
You build places and buildings for people. Without people, they would not work. There would be no return on your investment anyway. And they would be soulless. And I think part of it was to put the soul into this development.
Can large-scale developments become catalysts for better neighbourhoods? This week, we hone in on two specific projects and explore the repurposing efforts to bring new life to a decommissioned coal-fired power station in London and an old Sears shopping centre in New York State. And we ask if it can all be done with community in mind. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, we're going to start today's programme here in London on the south bank of the River Thames. It's been over a decade in the making, but the newly repurposed Battersea Power Station is set to finally start welcoming people at the end of the summer. The redevelopment of the Grade 2 listed building has been the subject of much scrutiny and anticipation by urban aficionados and residents alike. Covering around 42 acres, its impact on the city could be tremendous. That's precisely the reason why we wanted to catch up with Sarah Banham, who's the Head of Communities and Sustainability at Battersea Power Station Development Company. Sarah has a tough task to ensure that a large-scale development can foster a real community spirit, as well as creating new jobs and connecting the north-south divide at the same time. So, how are they doing? Well, Sarah stopped by our studios in London a little bit earlier.
It's a 42-acre mixed-use development, creating a new neighbourhood for London. And it's in London Central Activity Zone, and it is totally mixed-use. So it's a mixture of residential, commercial office space, shops, offices, cafes, leisure, over 19 acres of public realm, park, open space. So, yes, a huge development, and it's been a long time coming.
Now, you're in charge of communities and sustainability. What does that title entail then?
So it's a very broad title that covers our sort of four main themes, which is environment, economy, jobs and education, and community itself. And I think from the very, very beginning, we've had a real focus on community and bringing our local community with us on this journey to create this new neighbourhood, which is for them as well as for wider London.
We should explain to listeners, so where it sits, it's south of the river, but Battersea has a real sense of community already. There is a strong vibrancy there. So you have this empty, huge piece of estate that's now being brought back to life. I presume that there were quite a lot of opinions about what community should look like as you began to engage with people.
There were masses of differing views, but I think overall, the local community was quite fatigued by all the developers who had come and gone and promised, you know, the crock of gold at the end of the rainbow or whatever. And it's been an iterative process. When the power station was first decommissioned, it was literally a small island site. So the power station's footprint itself is 6 acres. And then gradually over time, the rest of the land holding has expanded to the 42 acres it is today. And the community have just sat there and watched this building sort of slowly crumble. there's been an emotional attachment to it, and it's sort of ingrained within their lives. You can't miss it. It's huge. And I think it was really important that they felt part of the whole development process. So way back, I've been on the project for 15 years, way back we started conversations and listening and what people wanted in basically their backyard.
Now, those conversations are great, and we've seen around the world when you begin these conversations, as we said, there's a lot of differing views, and there was some pushback, I know, even with Battersea about how much of it should be affordable housing, and there were some questions raised there. But you've got to make money as a development. You've got to generate interest in the site and make it an appealing place for companies to come and relocate. So again, as those conversations happen and you're trying to bring the community along, how difficult is it? How many late night meetings are there with town hall scenarios where you're trying to explain what's going on?
There's quite a lot. And it's very different audiences who want different things. But I think you've got to sort of rewind and understand why it took so long for this project to really get going. And it was an isolated island site on its own in Nine Elms, which was essentially a parking lot for white vans and red vans from the post office. And it was the coming together of various different things that unlocked it. But the game changer was the Northern Line extension, because the accessibility levels for public transport in Nine Elms were dire. I mean, Battersea doesn't have a tube anyway, and this has really, really changed it. And what it's done, and certainly with the power station development, it's opened up that north-south connection. Everyone always thinks of London as going along the river, east-west, but actually that north-south and opening up the hinterland to the community behind Battersea Park Road, Nine Elms Lane, was really crucial.
Why is it important to have this aspect, this job that you're doing? When you come in the morning to work, do you think, we've got just so many stakeholders involved in this, I need to try and marshal everyone along? Or are you trying to just get an overarching narrative going so that actually people can come and make up their own decisions?
I think it's slightly what you've said, where people can make up their own decisions because you've got such a varied audience. But essentially, you build places and buildings for people. Without people, they would not work. There would be no return on your investment anyway, and they would be soulless. And I think part of it was to put the soul into this development, but also it's a legacy as well, because our current shareholders, the Malaysian shareholders, have had this site for 10 years. They are still developing it. It's a long, long project. They're not just going to build it and walk away. It's really important that it's successful for those people who live there, work there, visit there, live in the neighbourhood, live in London. It's got to be tangible to the people on the ground.
And give us some examples of what those tangible elements are. Is that jobs? Is that places for education? Is that places for entertainment? What are the gets for the local community then, do you think?
So it's a true town centre. It's the sixth town centre for Wandsworth. So it's got that whole mixture of leisure, retail, cultural activities going on. For me, one of the key benefits is the jobs. So by the time the development's finished, there'll be over 20,000 jobs created on that site, which is really difficult to try and imagine. We started with the construction side, so we've got nearly 700 local people into employment on the construction side. And then to add to that, 167 local apprentices and then other apprenticeships on top of that. And now we've started on the sort of operational estate. 31% of the people who work on phase one, which is Circus West Village, are local people. And it's that sort of benefit and focus that I think really flows out into the community. You get that ripple effect from it as well.
So when it comes to something like retail, you know, and I remember speaking to some people from Battersea a few years ago now when they were saying, well, what we hope will happen is, you know, that there'll be footholds for people who are already running businesses in the postcode who will be able to bring their businesses in, we'll help them get going in the initial stages. But of course, you know, it's a very appealing piece of real estate. I presume there's lots of chains and bigger companies that want to be in there. How do you balance something like retail? Do you think ultimately it's whether it serves the community that's within our dominion, or are you thinking, again, that it's about the jobs that you can create? How do you go about trying to engineer something like retail?
I think it comes through the whole sort of vision for the development and the sort of placemaking. So for Circus West Village, we had very much a focus on small, independent retailers and sort of nurturing them and allowing them the space to grow. So, for example, the cinema that we've got in the railway arches, we have helped them, we've looked after them, we go to the cinema, but they are now taking the main cinema space in the power station as well. So they've been able to grow with us. And then another example was when COVID was coming out slightly more, giving us slightly more freedom, we had a pop-up of Vanmoof electric bikes, and take-up was so good that they've now taken a unit in Circus West Village. So it's just nurturing and seeing those opportunities, I think.
Now, what's funny about London is, you know, that we have this traditional kind of resistance to crossing over the river. As you said, you're trying to get people going north-south. Parts of London do change and adapt all the time, so it's pulling in every direction. Who are you finding is coming to the development all the way along that part of the river? Who is coming? Is it people from all around London, or is it very much a kind of local play?
I think it's very much from all over London. I think word is actually getting out there. To start with, it's been very locally focused. Obviously, during the last 2 years, there has been a real neighbour focus on it, where people can walk there. We're right next door to Battersea Park as well, which is 200 acres of fantastic green space. So that also helps. But I think people are discovering it, and we're on the Uber Thames Clipper, so people are coming there. It's becoming more of a destination. We have a wide events programme. So, for example, we've got the Light Festival on at the moment, which helps brighten up January and rather wet February days. And so people come to see that as well. And there's a real curiosity about the building and what's going on. People cannot wait to get inside. So I think it's not just going to be visitors for the retail attractions or the food. There will be people who come for its history and that sense of place. And it's on the Thames. It's beautiful.
We said at the beginning of this that you have a very good title, Head of Communities and Sustainability. So tell us a little bit about the sustainability part. How can a project like this ever really be sustainable? How are you trying to make that work?
So if we'd knocked down the power station, which we can't do because it's Grade 2 star listed, but the amount of carbon in that building, I think it's something like 36,000 tonnes or something. It's huge. But by readapting it and not knocking down the structures, but reinforcing the current steel structure within it, reinforcing and repairing various bits of it, we have saved a lot on that side. But we're also putting in green space as well as brown roofs. We have an on-site ornithologist who's recorded, I think it's something like 95 species of bird overflying the site. We've got resident peregrine falcons who breed. We've had to manage the whole construction programme around them. So there's lots of biodiversity, lots of initiatives, and our contractors, I know construction industry has quite a bad name for being dirty and filthy, but actually they have really upped their game. And in scope 1 and 2 emissions, they are now carbon neutral.
You started your job, it turns out, just when Monocle was starting. We're 15 years old this week. So the next 15 years, I know we've been planning out in our heads what that means for us, but for Battersea and for the role that you, not saying you're definitely going to have to stick there for another 15 years, but what does it mean in another 15 years, do you think, for the project?
I think it's very exciting the way technology is advancing and addressing climate change. I think that's really important, and that's particularly on our future phases and our new build bit, but also how our community come along with us and adapt, and making sure that there aren't any barriers. The vision has been we are not a gated community. So what we have is we have a community choir, which is over 100 people strong, and that's made up from people from the development, but principally people from within the neighbourhood. And they all come together and sing together as one. And it means you then get that cross-fertilisation across that road and across the park and across the river. And it's just that movement of people, I think. I think, for me, that is key to a successful place.
Yeah, and just a footnote on that, I used to, some years ago, work in Canary Wharf, and even though that's not a gated community, it very much felt like a gated community. And I think this thing you talk about, getting people to cross roads, you know, there is no barrier, but people feel some kind of sense of, you know, am I the right person to enter in there? So amazing something as simple as a choir can get people to cross the road and feel part of it.
Oh, it's incredible. And I mean, during lockdown, it was so important to well-being for our community. It really was. And when we talk about our community, it is not just Battersea Power Station. It is our community.
That was Sarah Banham, the head of communities and sustainability at the Battersea Power Station Development Company. This is The Urbanist. It's time now to head to New York State to see a retail to healthcare transformation going on in the city of Rochester. The global design practice Perkins & Will, along with the architecture firm Slam Collective, are behind a 20-acre suburban Rochester shopping mall that's being transformed into a state-of-the-art healthcare campus. Monocle's New York correspondent Henry Sheridan recently visited the Perkins & Will offices to find out more, and he met with Rob Goodwin, the architectural design director of the firm's New York hub. Rob began by explaining the genesis behind this exciting new project.
So when we were first hired, they actually didn't have a site for this project, and we were asked to work with them to explore a series of different opportunities, ranging from a completely greenfield site to some that were more previously developed. So as we looked at them, you know, there are pros and cons to each of them, and you know, when you have a greenfield site, you can sort of do whatever you want, but you don't have much infrastructure there. One of the benefits of the mall site that was ultimately chosen was that it was easily accessible. It's not far away from the New York State Thruway. It was right off a main street. People knew where it was. It was easily accessible to people. And it also was an existing building. So we couldn't keep everything in the building, but we stripped it down to a certain level and then were able to reuse a lot of it to make the building work. And of course, there's, you know, it was a flat site with a lot of access for parking and that sort of thing. So there were benefits to that as well. So it eventually just became a decision that was made as a collaboration with the owner that this made the most sense for them. And they entered into an agreement with the mall owners. And to be clear, we're not taking the entire mall. It's just sort of one wing of it. It's sort of a cruciform in plan. We're taking one of the ends of that cruciform, which used to be the Sears building, and turning it into this orthopedic center.
Tell me a little bit in general terms about why mall structures lend themselves to conversion into healthcare centers. What properties do the buildings have which perhaps are shared by conventional hospital buildings or meet the same needs?
So to be clear, it's not a hospital. It's ambulatory orthopedics, which is slightly different. There's no hospital beds there. But, you know, the thing about this Sears building was it's one story. It had a generous ceiling height. If you've ever been in a Sears building, you know, the relatively high ceilings, and a very open column grid. And so that kind of flexibility lends itself very well to certain parts of the program of the building we did. So we looked at that being used to put the sort of high-tech spaces, the operating rooms, the procedure rooms, the imaging spaces where you get an MRI, that sort of thing. And they're equipment heavy, so we wanted to have those on the ground floor. So we did have to upgrade things like the slab. The first floor concrete slab had to be replaced. Certain parts of the exterior wall were removed. Certainly new mechanical systems were put in. But the basic shell of the building was highly adaptable to these sort of what we call diagnostic and treatment spaces that are a little more high tech. And then the other part of this was that we added a clinic tower, which, when I say tower, it's really only four stories, but a vertical stacking of exam rooms and physicians' offices and that sort of thing that helped counteract the horizontality of the existing space and give it more of an identity on the skyline. And then actually the third component is a rehab space. So in the rehab space, we took over adjacent to the Sears was a part of the actual mall, and we transformed that by carving a courtyard out of that big horizontal space to bring daylight in. and then wrapping it with rehab spaces and actually treating that courtyard not just as a green space for daylight, but actually as an extension of the treatment area. Let's say you've hurt your knee and you have to do exercises for rehab for that. You can actually go outside and do your exercises outdoors, you know, so that in good weather, that's actually a real benefit.
I'm interested in hearing from you if you think that this project could be part of a broader trend of adaptation of pre-existing non-medical structures into medical facilities, particularly with reference to how urban healthcare provision needs have changed over the course of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think one of the things that has become clear in the pandemic is that we can do a lot of things remotely now. And one of them is healthcare. There's a lot more telemedicine going on that's become a bit of a sort of an eye-opener for a lot of institutions. But at the same time, that's followed on a trend that began before the pandemic about the decentralization of healthcare, you know, out of the kind of core main hospital and out into the community. And a lot of the major institutions here in New York have been doing that for quite a while, building satellite facilities. We did one for Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center out in Monmouth County in New Jersey, and looking at a number of those for Hartford Healthcare in Connecticut. So the notion that you really, for certain kinds of care, you bring it into the community, you bring it to the people as opposed to the people coming to you. And that, on one level, makes it more accessible for the patients and their families. At the same time, it allows these institutions to reinvent the way care is delivered. It's not in this dense, urban, often a little bit intimidating environment that people think of in hospitals, but they can then hire someone like us to design a space that is more accessible, more comfortable, and perhaps changes the nature of what people think of as healthcare into something new. And I think in Rochester especially, we were able to achieve that.
Yeah, I'm interested in talking a little bit more about that, the possible psychological benefits or psychosocial benefits of using types of structure or locations that people might have a more positive association with than they do with conventional hospitals or medical centres. Do you think that that's something that architects should be aware of capitalizing upon when they're enlisted to do these kinds of projects in the future?
The challenge if you're building in a dense urban environment is often your land is limited, the site is constrained by other things, and so your palette of design opportunities is limited. Whereas once you have a more open and flexible environment, you can really start to introduce new ideas, and there's been a trend towards biophilia, which is really the idea that people have a tendency to relate well to nature and to think of nature as a source of healing. We've done a number of designs for various institutions around the country that really use nature as an inspiration for the environment and healthcare, that it's not a secondary thing, but actually very much a primary driver of the way the design is created. So there's that aspect. I think, as I said before, the accessibility is something you can make it much more convenient. And because you have less dense environment, you can bring in daylight much more easily. You can perhaps use different materials. You know, there's a whole range of possibilities that open up when you're working in a looser and more flexible environment. I think there is an aspect of this that's also about equity. I think that there are definitely people who find the notion of going to the hospital, for example, intimidating, but also challenging from a, you have to have a car typically, and you've got to take time off work. And there's a sense that a hospital is a symbol of authority. And I think this notion of bringing healthcare into the community is actually a way to make it more accessible in social terms to people, and that they can become more comfortable with that experience. And hopefully that allows healthcare to become delivered more consistently around the country and hopefully around the world.
The flip side of, you know, the same forces and factors that have made healthcare and so many other things, you know, remote, have also led to the decline of high street brick and mortar stores. Do you think that's going to lead to a kind of replacement effect where if you picture the average high street in an American urban environment in 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years, do you think that we're going to see a significant number of storefronts being used for healthcare and other functions which are more difficult to do remotely where there used to be retail stores.
It's interesting because retail, brick and mortar retail, is struggling these days. And we have various clients now who are looking for the idea of healthcare as a tenancy in a mixed use building. So I think that the notion of having a storefront that is for, say, an urgent care center is not new. That's been around for, at least 10 years, that you come into a suburban strip mall, for example, and one of the stores is an urgent care facility. It's actually where I got my first COVID test. I'm sort of used to that, and it's easy to park and get into and that sort of thing. So that's already there. And I think the trend now is actually more about the scale of these things. That the one that we're doing in Rochester is 350,000 square feet, so not a small thing. And it's starting to re-envision the environment that you can create through scale as opposed to just sort of fitting into something else. At the same time, there's sort of a symbiotic relationship between retail and healthcare, that one of the advantages for the mall owners here was that they could see increased traffic in their mall because people could come, especially for orthopedics, which is sort of one of the healthcare disciplines that's a little bit more well as opposed to sick. You come to do rehab for your knee, yes, it hurts and everything, but it's not the same kind of acuity that you would have with other things. So that synergy that comes from co-locating healthcare and conventional retail can reinforce each other. And people can come and do two things at once, and they come to an environment they're used to. And so I think that you are going to see more and more of this as land becomes more in demand. There's always going to be opportunities for this, but I think that people are becoming more and more used to the idea of seeing healthcare as a retail component. And I think you're going to see that the scale of these things does increase over time.
And it's attached to a university as well, the healthcare center that you worked on, the University of Rochester. Education, higher education particularly, is also a sector that's been enormously disrupted by the pandemic, particularly in relation to, physically locating students in a centralized campus. Do you think that's another sector where you could see, for example, universities decentralizing, taking advantage of different types of structure and maybe, being a little bit more spread out in the future?
Yeah, the hospital is the main hospital of the University of Rochester, but the medical center is its own institution. I mean, they have a relationship, obviously, but the hospital operates primarily independently of the university. But I taught a semester at a university in Rhode Island during the pandemic. And the initial premise was that I would do the entire thing remotely. And I wasn't quite sure how that was going to go. Eventually, what I did was I mixed both in-person and remote. But I was quite surprised how easily it worked to teach remotely. That said, once I came onto campus, the students were really happy that I was there in person. I think they craved the ability to actually talk to people in person. So I think there's a balance there. But I think probably, especially for universities that are challenged in terms of finding space or land for new facilities, the potential for the same sort of idea of decentralization, I think, could definitely be something that we see in the future. I'm by no means an expert on that, but my instinct is that, that would be true.
Rob Goodwin, the architectural director of Perkins & Will's New York office there, in conversation with our New York correspondent, Henry Reece Sheridan. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of The Urbanist. And if you're a fan of the show, don't forget to subscribe for your weekly dose of urbanism. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at monocle.com. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to play you out this week, here's Badly Drawn Boy with Once Around the Block. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. I want to repair your desire. No longer